This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Season 21, Episode 21. This is Writing Excuses.
Rhythm in words.
Tools, not rules.
For writers, by writers.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Howard.
Today, we're going to kind of continue our conversation from last week about sequencing, where we got kind of micro at the end, by talking about rhythm, which is a form of sequencing, honestly. Mm-hmm. And as somebody who loves music, I love thinking about sequence, like how rhythm works and how rhythm creates like a sense of movement through a piece. And I'm curious, like, how much I think a lot about the rhythm of sentences, like obsessively so. I will change words over and over and over again to get the right emphasis, to find a word that is like, this means big, but I also want a three-syllable word with the emphasis on the second syllable so that the way that I rhythmically wrote it is the way that other people read it. So my question to you is, am I just controlling? Or do other people do this too?
No, I think you're absolutely spot on to be paying attention and interested in that. I think a real failure state of people who are trying to write elevated prose, quote unquote, is they reach for the bigger, more complicated, more flowery language, right? They make it a language thing versus or a descriptive thing. They're just going to go all in on talking about, you know, the architectural details of this mansion or whatever it is, when one of the main ways to grab your reader and make something feel really beautiful, put us in an emotional state where we really appreciate the thing, is to use musicality and rhythm, right? Is to use breaths and pause and word length to pull us through and give us something that feels beautiful.
I think a lot about the rhythm, and I also think a lot about the syllable sounds. I mean, when you're reading silently to yourself, I suppose it could be argued that there's no noise, but those syllables still have, they still have sounds. You can have a jumping marsupial, or you can have a kangaroo. And kangaroo is... The K and the G just kind of make it a funny word, mm-hmm. in the same way that jackalope is kind of a funny word. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just know that when I am looking for the right rhythm to make a point, I am also looking for the right sounds to go with that rhythm, in order to make the point even better.
I also think about it as well. I going back to what you were saying, I think the issue is that a lot of people think more is better, and it's not always. Mm-hmm. Partly is coming out of puppetry and art, but I think about the negative spaces. There's a thing with puppets where we have a zero position, the spot that they return to. And then the movement comes out from that spot. So I tend to think about that a little bit on the page, about what is sort of the zero position, what's the resting state of this prose, the natural sentence length for this thing. And then using my rhythm to break from that. So I'll go into a sentence that's much longer than that for one type of emphasis, or a sentence that's much shorter, a paragraph that's much shorter. And likewise, Erin, I also will massage the words so that the stress falls into the right spot. In part because when I'm narrating, I'm sometimes narrating other people's stuff and they have accidental couplets in their fiction. And it's like trying to fix that as a narrator is so hard, and it's drawing attention often to things that you just don't want attention drawn to. It's just 100% an accident.
Accidental one of the couplets in their fiction?
Oh my goodness.
See how that causes friction.
Good Lord.
anybody want a peanut?
One thing I think about a lot when it comes to this as well is negative space, right? There's this Japanese concept of ma, which is sort of the space around the thing, or considering the negative space as its own thing that should be considered and has value and weight in a scene. And this can be applied in a number of ways, both in terms of like thinking about what you're not describing, think about where the breaths are in your sentence, and then literally think about how it looks on the page, mm-hmm. right? One thing I see a lot is really dense blocks of text. If you have like an entire paragraph that's just dense description with no line breaks, with no paragraph breaks, it's very hard to ingest, right? One of my deep interests in my sort of academic background is in British modernism. It's like one of my favorite periods in literature. I'm endlessly fascinated with the modernists. One of the things they really did was start to play with that negative space in very deliberate ways. James Joyce famously in his books will have entire pages that are just one sentence with no breaks, which was designed to create a very deliberate emotional effect in the reader, which is one that is a state of complete overwhelm and being subsumed in the interior monologue of a character. Because there are no breaths in it, it is incredibly difficult to read and overwhelming to try and process what he is talking about, because there's no space for breath in it, right? And so when you think about how to use that negative space, when you think about sort of like poets who started to break with traditional line structure and sort of give that blank space for half of a line, for, you know, breaking in the middle of a word, those kind of things, you'll start to sort of see the potential of using the physicality of the page, using those points where you can take a breath as active things that you are including in your fiction.
I'm glad that you talked about the visual aspect of the negative space on the page, because even if you're not doing poetry or you're not doing something that's experimental, you can still sort of get a sense of the rhythm of your piece by just backing the view away. Yeah. Like you can set up your word processor so you can see multiple pages all at once. And if you look at it and there's a certain sameness to it, to your paragraphs, then you're using the same rhythm over and over again. There are times that's actually 100% appropriate. But as we've talked about with other forms of pacing, when you're rhythmically all the same, it can become fatiguing without anyone knowing why it is fatiguing.
A very simple example, it makes me insane when somebody sends me jacket copy that is one big paragraph, mm-hmm. right? Or if you're writing a query letter, here's my biggest query letter pitch or my pitch sort of note for you, right? The simple tip, make sure no paragraph is longer than three sentences. Make sure each paragraph is short and to the point and give me negative space so that I can read it quickly and process it quickly. If you give me one long paragraph, it's so hard to process it when you're trying to go fast, as one is when reading jacket copy, when reading a pitch.
And I am just going to flag that this is definitely a tool for submitting to a specific agent. And that other agents may have different preferences.
Always. They are wrong, and they should feel bad about it.
There are circumstances in which the words that you put on the page, you have 100% control over the way they flow, where the line feeds are, where the breaks are. The most common case of this is squarely in my wheelhouse, and that's in comics, a comic dialogue bubble. I find that most of the skills that I have for wordsmithing something, for massaging the text, grew out of necessity, because when I'm trying to put things in the bubble, I want to be able to break the words so that they will easily form an ellipse. They're be contained by an ellipse, or be, you know, if they're up in a corner, that they will be kind of an elliptical shape on one edge and a corner shape on the other, and that there won't be rivers and valleys, you know, the spaces between the words. You won't have a stack of O's or E's or I's right on top of each other. And this seems like a really silly thing for a writer to need to think about, but there are definitely circumstances in which you realize that what you've written won't work because the way it is being printed on the page, it is full of rivers and valleys and stacked letters, which creates a distraction, and it will no longer be read the way it would be spoken if you didn't see it on the page.
You know, I find it really interesting that we've been talking about these like blocks and blocks of text on the page, because I recently went to a writing group and somebody noted that one of my sentences was 87 words long.
Hell yeah, let's go.
And I'm going to explain why that's totally okay using poetry after the break.
The cruise ship sailing us to Alaska this summer is completely sold out, except for the cabins we've reserved for Writing Excuses attendees. These cabins are only available until June 4th. On June 4th, any cabins not reserved by Writing Excuses attendees will revert to the cruise line and will be sold to the general public. If you want to join the Writing Excuses hosts and 100 new friends on our final annual cruise as we read, write, critique, and learn while reveling in the stunning scenery, visit writingexcuses.com/retreats. Don't delay. We're holding the very last unreserved cabins on the entire ship, and they will not stay unreserved for very long. Again, that's writingexcuses.com/retreats. Thanks to HomeServe for sponsoring this episode. The little kids were giggling downstairs, and I heard something about catching raindrops. Sure enough, the ceiling was slowly dripping water, and the kids were delighted. I was not. An upstairs toilet had overflowed. The floor and ceiling both needed repairs, but the kids were okay despite having caught raindrops in their mouths. Regular homeowners insurance usually doesn't cover these kinds of indoor raindrops, and that's where HomeServe comes in, simplifying your life when your home's plumbing, HVAC, or electrical systems introduce you to exciting new failure modes. You don't want to be scrambling for a contractor while the water gets deeper. You want to be on the phone with HomeServe's 7x24 hotline. HomeServe has been helping homeowners for over 20 years with a trusted national network of 2,600 local contractors. Help protect your home systems and your wallet with HomeServe against covered repairs. Plans start at just $4.99 a month. Go to homeserve.com to find the plan that's right for you. That's homeserve.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs. Don't drink indoor raindrops.
If your anxiety, depression, or ADHD are more than a rough patch, you don't just need another meditation app. Talkiatry makes it easy to see a psychiatrist online using your insurance in days. Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatry practice that provides comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, and ongoing medication management for conditions like ADHD, anxiety, depression, bipolar, OCD, PTSD, insomnia, and more. Unlike therapy-only apps, Talkiatry is psychiatry. That means you're seeing a medical provider who can diagnose mental health conditions and prescribe medication when it's appropriate. All of their 600-plus clinicians are in-network with major insurers, so you can use your existing insurance instead of paying monthly subscriptions or out-of-network fees. You'll meet with an experienced, licensed psychiatrist who takes the time to understand what's going on, builds a personalized treatment plan, and can prescribe medication when it's right for you. Your care stays consistent and evidence-based. Getting started with Talkiatry takes just a few minutes. Complete a short online assessment, get matched with clinicians who fit your needs, and schedule your first visit in days, not months. More than 300,000 patients have already found high-quality psychiatric care through Talkiatry. Head to talkiatry.com/WX and complete the short assessment to get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes.
As promised, one of the reasons that I love rhythm is that I love long blocks of sentences. I want to beat you over the head with large blocks and large blocks on the page. And so One of the ways that
I
do
this. Once
again,
I feel like I need to not be sitting next to Aaron anymore. I feel very threatened.
Yes, mission accomplished. And one of the ways I do this is if you can create a rhythm in the way in which somebody will read something. Mm-hmm. This is why I think so much about stress. It sort of, you don't notice it. It's sort of the way that, like, feel like sometimes I'm just putting my reader on a horse and then just like hitting the horse on the butt. Is that how you get horses to go?
Yeah. Sure.
And then, and they're just galloping off. And when you're galloping on a horse, something I haven't done since I was three, but I'm going to assume there's some sort of rhythm.
When were you galloping on a horse when you were three?
Three is so young to be galloping on a horse. Anyways, continue.
It was Mississippi. Anyway. It's true. But anyway, so what you're doing is the horse has some sort of rhythm and it's just carrying you along.
Yes.
So I want my story to be your horse. Yeah. That sounds weird. And so I like to think about like some of the things that poets use, which are like the actual, like if you ever talk to poets, they'll explain like this is in like trochaic foot or iambic pentameter or all these other things. And I'm going to share with you some of my favorites because I want to. Okay, so iambs, you know, iambs from Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. That's da-dum, 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 which is, you know, my favorite two examples of this are, but soft what light through yonder window breaks. Mm-hmm. But also, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about them. I don't know. Tell me if you think this is true. That like makes you feel there's something about them that is a lean in because the emphasis is on the second syllable and because it's a double, which is like a lot of like just like a horse. Da-dum, da-dum. There's a lot of feeling like you're leaning in to what the other person is saying and you need to understand what's going on. And so it makes sense when you are speaking to Juliet on her balcony or trying to convince a large number of people as the second example, like that this is like we have made it to the promised land. Preachers love a good iamb and preachers love rhythm in general. If you want a good example of rhythm, listen to a Southern Baptist preacher.
Oh my God.
They are great at it. Like they will take everything and make it sound rhythmic. They'll be like, I went to the grocery store. And you're like, oh my gosh.
I mean,
this is amazing.
Rap and hip hop as well. Old school boom bap. That's an iamb, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Speaking of, actually, I'm going to skip ahead to a spondee, which is where both have the same. So as opposed to emphasis being on the front, which I'll get back to, or emphasis being on the back. It's like everything is the same. It's paired, but it's like there's no emphasis one way or the other. And my favorite example of this is that butt was stuffed from the end of Sir Mix-a-Lot because he's doing all this other rhythm, but then he stops and he uses equal emphasis because all of those words are important.
Yeah.
And also because it draws attention, much like the butt does to Sir Mix-a-Lot, to that section of the rhythm.
And it brings it to a screeching halt in that moment. And we have to take a beat to process it. And then it picks up again, right? Like,
exactly.
Yeah, as opposed to if it had all been straight emphasis all the way through.
Yeah.
You would have not. Who would have cared?
Yeah.
Who would have noticed that butt?
Stuffed or unstuffed.
Wow. I'm sorry. I'm taking us off the... We're on a horse now. This episode...
Are we in Mississippi or is the horse
named
Mississippi?
I'm so glad we somehow got from James Joyce to Sir Mix-a-Lot and I'm delighted. Yeah.
And then the other one, the last sort of like double that I really like is the one where your emphasis is first. So da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. Mm-hmm. This is the Poe. Once upon a midnight dreary while I pondered weak and weary. And so it's also used. Taylor Swift loves it. Nice to meet you where you've been. Yep. There's a lot. Taylor Swift often uses those things because I think it makes it pop more.
Yeah.
It's in your face a little more and it feels a little more, I don't know.
It's like the trochaic tetrameter. Is that the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Mm-hmm. Is that the same with it on the...
Yeah.
I like that. It is.
Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble, where the accent is first.
Double, double.
Double, double. Yeah.
I mean, bubble, bubble, I guess, if you're doing chewing
double,
gum.
Double, bubble, chewing gum.
Yeah. But Shakespeare, there's a great TV show called Slings and Arrows. I think they only had three seasons. And it's following a theater company. But in one of the episodes, they're doing Lear, and this older Shakespearean actor is railing at one of the younger actors who is trying to ignore the meter.
Mm.
And he's like, no, the meter tells you where it is important. Shakespeare would put the emphasis on the important words, and, you know, but soft, you know, but is not important, but soft, what light. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of an interesting thing when you're thinking about your own prose. Where do you want to throw the emphasis? And when do you want to break that rhythm to draw people's attention to it?
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Are the ands important or is the tomorrow, mm-hmm. right? And how you read the scanning on that changes the meaning of the line wildly, right?
Like, yeah. There's also a really fantastic, hilarious thing where there's an actor who's attempting to do Hamlet, mm-hmm. and different famous people who have played Hamlet come out and give him a line read on to be or not to be. And each of them picks a different word to emphasize, mm-hmm. Which changes the meaning. And that's something that's very easy to do in spoken word, but on the page, when you're playing with rhythm, not only are you looking at these beats, but you're also looking at italics as a tool, which you can use or wildly misuse.
It is worth sitting down with a breakdown of a Kendrick Lamar song and just see how he uses rhythm to shift your attention and your emotional state when he moves from doubles to triplets, when he moves back, you know, like the number, the complexity of what he's doing with rhythm. Same with Eminem. You know, if you go and look at the complete breakdown of how they're using rhythm, when they're using twos, when they're using threes, things like that, can be so useful for understanding the musicality of prose, right? It sounds like we're getting, you know, we're talking Shakespeare, we're talking literature, we're talking music, like all these different things that may feel far from trying to write contemporary science fiction or fantasy prose. But I promise you that the more you internalize these tools, the more you can apply them unconsciously in moments where you need that.
But emphasis. Knowing the names of them, knowing that, you know, a trochee is double, you know, accent, unaccent, that a spondee is, you know, all the same, that an iamb is unaccented, accented. Just having words for it means that when you are troubleshooting what you are writing, you have names for the problem you're trying to solve, and you can sort things out in your head more quickly.
I will say your mileage may vary on that, right? For me, you know, I struggled when I was being formally taught poetry because I had to learn all the names of things. Once I learned to sit and appreciate poetry, then I had a very different relationship to the rhythms of it. And, you know, but for a lot of people, the knowing the structure of the names will be very helpful.
And you don't have to either, because again, most of this is stuff that we have actually internalized and then reverse engineered to come up with names for. The simplest thing you can do to check the rhythm is to read your work out loud. If reading your work out loud is not something that works for you, having a machine read it out loud, because if it is possible for that machine to get it wrong, and it is, it will do it. So reading it out loud is a very, very useful way. That's where you will spot the, oh, I do have an accidental couplet here, or like internal rhymes can be really, we didn't talk about this much, but internal rhymes can be really, really powerful tool, but you can also like completely break things by, you know, I'm constantly accidentally writing, "She rose on her toes," and I'm like, ugh, it's like drawing this attention to something that I,
as long as she doesn't do anything with her nose at the same time.
I think one thing that's also really useful to think about is think about cussing, you know, like where. Basically, swearing is all about rhythm, like where you're putting the cusses in your sentence, where you're putting that or how you're sequencing and ordering them. Someone who's bad at it is always putting them in the wrong place and you can feel it. And there's no impact to it. When you get someone who's like phenomenal at swearing, this is why Shakespeare swearing is the best thing in the world, because when you can just like get the rhythm of it right, it's so dependent on that. It's swearing is so dependent on the musicality of the words that we choose. And that's why certain swear words are just more fun than other ones.
"Thou art a knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, 100-pound, filthy, worsted stocking knave, a lily-livered, action-taking, whore-son, glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogue, one that I would speak into clamorous whining if thou deniest the least syllable of thy addition."
People say that about me all the time.
Well, that's
it's very hurtful.
Rarely to your face.
I know.
King Lear.
I'm not surprised, honestly. King Lear, Act 2, Scene 2, Kent to Oswald, and I have it a little bit wrong, but it's pretty close.
I will say, before we head to the homework or start insulting each other for real, that I also like, in addition to looking at hip-hop, looking at covers.
Yeah.
When you see an artist, like a really well-known song that like 10,000 people have done this same jazz song, one way that people distinguish it is by playing with the rhythm. And if you ever hear a song and you're like, wow, this new interpretation made me think about the meaning of the song differently because the emphasis was in a different place, mm-hmm. you are actually seeing what is happening when rhythm is tweaked with mm-hmm. in real time. And so with that, I am going to take us to the homework. And your homework for this is to listen to a piece of music that you really like and think about how does the rhythm work within that? Are they emphasizing the first word or the second word? Does it get faster and then slower? You can use really official terms and be very poetry class, or you can just be like, fast here, many words, yay. And then I want you to take a piece of your writing and see what happens if you use that same rhythmic structure in your own piece and how it changes like a piece of description that you have in your own writing.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Aaron Roberts, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.